Episode 24 of By Our Own Hands. Oscar looked over the hills and towards a mountain. He knew instantly that he was looking in a direction of Oisin's Glen. He didn't know how he could be so certain, but he was. He turned towards the threesome again and saw that they had all moved towards him. "You have come for work," the man said to him with a clipped English accent. "Yes, I have come from Kildorey. Father Sullivan sent me," Oscar said. "That is a long way to walk. I am Frederick Trench," the man said, extending his hand. Oscar shook his hand. He stared at the man. He remembered Father Sullivan's words. One of the young ladies of Castle Oliver was to marry a gentleman named Trench. "My name is Oscar Dorian," he said. "Mr. Nathaniel Buckley recently purchased your land, I believe," Frederick said. "I have heard that he is a villain of a man," one of the young ladies said. Frederick chuckled. "Hush, Elizabeth," the other young lady said. "Mary, it is true," Elizabeth said. "It is true. That is why I have come for work. My rent is to be increased threefold," Oscar said. "How will you tend to your land if I hire you?" Frederick asked. "I will not. My wife will take care of our land," Oscar said. They all fell silent. Mary stepped forward. "I saw you admiring our land a moment ago," Mary said softly. "Yes, my family once lived in the Glen of Oisin. That was long ago," Oscar said. She nodded knowingly. The two sisters exchanged looks. "I know the tale," Mary said. "We both do," Elizabeth added. Oscar did not respond. "Can you begin tomorrow?" Elizabeth asked. "Yes, I can," Oscar replied. "Very well. My fiancée will give you a tour," she said. Oscar looked at Frederick again. He could not disguise his surprise. "Are my clothes really that atrocious?" Frederick asked. They all laughed. "Come with me, Oscar," Frederick said. "Mr. Dorian, we do know the tale," Elizabeth said. Oscar searched her face for mockery, but there was none. She gave him a warm smile. She then turned and walked away with her sister. Oscar spent the remainder of the day touring the castle. He was correct to assume that renovations were being carried out in various parts of the castle. The castle was being renovated and expanded. The amount of work that had to be completed before the wedding of Frederick and Elizabeth was extensive, and the wedding was only a few months away. At the end of the day, Frederick asked Oscar about his village. "How many able-bodied men do you have in your village that are willing to work?" he asked. "I believe I could find 50 men without too much trouble," Oscar replied. "Bring them tomorrow. If there are too many, I can send some of them to my cousin's estate in Queens County," he said. "Queens County?" Oscar asked, before he could stop himself. "Yes, my cousin John Adair is also renovating his house. It is a long way to go, I know, but some of your men may be interested, especially if they are facing eviction because of Buckley's rent racking," he replied. Oscar thought of the tales he had been told of how his ancestors had been forced to leave their ancestral lands. He looked in the direction of Oisin's Glen again, and then looked at Frederick. The words rushed from him before he could stop himself. "I would be grateful for work here or at your cousin's estate," he said. "The pay will be the same, but my cousin John will also provide you with a cottage. Your wife will have to see to your land. That could be a hardship on you and her," Frederick said. "I will speak to her," he said. "Very well. I will see you tomorrow," he said. As Oscar walked back to his cottage, his thoughts drifted to the tales he had been bequeathed. He thought of Hugh and Princess Aoife, Hugh and Blathnet, Diarmaid and Grainne, Hugh and Kiva, and finally Rory and Niamh. The rack-renting of Buckley could be endured, or they could simply return home. He reached his cottage, and she greeted him. He told her of his good fortune and the choice they must make. He could not decide, so he told her that the decision must be hers to make. She placed his hand on her stomach and smiled at him. He knew then that he could not leave her to work their land. They would return to a land where neither had ever set foot. Oscar spent the remainder of the evening visiting all of the cottages in his village. He found many men eager to work. He even found some willing to leave for Leash. The following day, he left with 50 men, as he had predicted, and they arrived at Castle Oliver. They were all given work. 40 were to remain at the castle, and the other 10 were to depart for Leash with their families. Frederick took him aside shortly after he arrived. "What have you decided?" he asked. "I will go to your cousin's estate. My wife is with child. She cannot work our land. She will accompany me to Queen's County. We will give up our lease in Kildorey," Oscar replied. Frederick nodded. "I believe my fiancé wishes to speak with you regarding your lease," he said with a smile. Oscar did not respond. He did not know how to. He couldn't imagine why Elizabeth wished to speak with him about his lease and his troubles. When he returned that night, he began to prepare for their journey. He had not spoken with Elizabeth. He assumed that he would the following day. But they did not speak on the following day or the day after. Finally, the day came for his departure, and he still had not spoken to Elizabeth. She found him right before he was to leave. She stepped close to him and whispered, "All is taken care of." Oscar watched her walk away. He did not understand her words, but he would later learn their full meaning. It was a long journey to the estate of John Adair. When they arrived, they were all given a day to settle themselves into their cottages. Oscar reached for her hand as they stepped from the cart. They were shown to their cottage. It was small and freshly whitewashed. He placed his hand on her stomach and smiled at her. They entered their cottage. Their fire had already been lit in their hearth. The cottage contained furnishings, pots, pans, and even linens. They had taken very few belongings. Oscar had taken his tales that had been passed on to him. They had been carefully copied out by his ancestor Rory and then carried to Kildorey by Father O'Keefe. Oscar shared these tales with her. He made her promise to keep them safe and to help him pass on these tales to the child that grew inside her. On their second day, they met Mary Moore. She lived in a tiny cabin behind their cottage. She was little more than a child herself, but she already had an infant son. She arrived and stood on their doorstep. "They are all gone. Some were turned out. Others left on the coffin boats. He rid himself of them so that he could offer all of you these cottages," she said. She turned and started to walk away before she looked back again. "'Tis Sasana's wish to rid herself of all of us," she said. Sasana, the land of the Saxon, England. Mary had spat the word as if it sickened her. She did not return for several days, and then she started to visit regularly. When she visited, she was usually silent. When she spoke of Engorda Mór, the great hunger. She spoke of black potatoes and hungry children. She spoke of the fevers. She spoke of those she had lost and those that had turned her away when she had become round with child. Her own kin had shunned her, and then they too were lost. One day, shortly before she died, she sang a lament. A ghostly wind that blew with gust foretold a coming dread, a prophecy that countless ones shall join the parted dead. This prophecy was soon fulfilled, a mighty bore ashore, that washed the countless souls away, as foretold in Gorda Mor. The living filled the coffin boats, their sorrowed hearts did yearn, as they were sent across the sea, away to not return. And many lives were lost at sea to reach a distant shore. An awful journey plagued with death, 'twas their curse in Gorda Mor. The waves that crashed relentlessly, a dam could not dispel. That mighty boar that came to shore, 'twas Susanna's prideful swell. Susanna sighed, his will was done, O child I so adore. Our mistress gently lulled her slaves and forsook in Gorda Mor. The Lord would not abandon us, nor take from man his will. He gave to all the right to choose, to love, to hate, to kill. He heard our pleas, he knew our plight, our prayers he'd not ignore. The angels wept a flood of tears, their lament in Gorda Mor. The waves have ceased to crash ashore, the violent winds have stilled. A ghostly echo lingers on, 'twas Susanna's cursed will. Ah, carry on, but tell the tale, recall the days of yore. Lament our curse to not forget our bequest in Gorda Mor. When she had finished, she whispered, perhaps the violent winds have not yet stilled. Her tiny body had never recovered from near starvation, followed by pregnancy and childbirth. She was so young and yet so aged. She was wise, too. Shortly before she died, she moved into their cottage. She joined their family, which had recently welcomed a daughter. She brought her son, Sean, named for his father, John. John Adair was Sean O'Diordan. His name, Adair, was another form of a Dorian or Dorian. Queen's County, or Leash, was a region of Leinster. In Leinster, the first region conquered by England, Irish Gaelic names were sometimes anglicized with a simple A instead of O, followed by an apostrophe. John Adair, who sometimes called himself a Scotsman and sometimes an Englishman, was of the same descent as Oscar. Oscar told him so years later when he fell while working on his estate. Oscar had been on a roof when he had slipped. His fall would not have been fatal if he had received care. Instead, John Adair looked at him as he lay on the ground, slowly bleeding to death. He leaned close to Oscar and spoke, Roisin is too good for you. Oscar's vision began to blur. He struggled to speak. If she is too good for me, then she is certainly too good for you, he choked. Oscar reached towards him with the last of his strength. He grabbed him. You and I are kin, but we are not both Irishmen, he whispered, before he succumbed to the darkness. Roisin heard them speak. She was terrified. She did not fight. She persevered. She preserved his tales, and she added to his tales. She added this tale. Roisin is your mother, he asked. Yes, I whisper. We are both silent for a time. He breaks the silence. In each century following the death of Hugh the Brehon, an ancestor of yours has been given a task and he has failed. He and his have been punished with exile. Your family's curse, the curse placed on Hugh the Brehan, remains intact. What was your father's task? How did he fail? He asked. His task was to impart his wisdom to another. To me, he did not fail, I say. But your family was exiled, he says. No, we were not. Elizabeth never discussed the details with my father when she last spoke with him. Instead, she sent a letter to him shortly after he arrived in Leash. She wrote that their family's paths had crossed once before and that her ancestors had done an injustice to his. She had taken it upon herself to try to make restitution for her ancestors' actions, I say. What did she do? He asked. She contacted Mr. Buckley. She told him that she was paying for the lease of Mr. and Mrs. Dorian. She asked for the maximum length he would agree to. He agreed to 31 years, which was the maximum allowed for a Roman Catholic in the dark days of the anti-Catholic penal laws. His reference to the previous restrictions was an insult, which he hoped would leave her unwilling to further negotiate with him. Instead, she sent his letter with the funds for 31 years to his land agent. His land agent quickly agreed and sent a binding lease before Buckley could stop him, I say. Dr. Foxlow chuckles. When that lease expired, did you renew? He asks. No, it was renewed for me for another decade, I say. I can return any time I wish to. My family was not exiled. I haven't returned because this is my home, I add, my voice catching. He stands up and walks to the window. He folds his hands behind his back. I believe that you have broken the curse, he says. He glances at me and then turns back to the window. When you were dismissed by Mrs. Adair, I went to your room. I was looking for your dog. I entered your room. Instead of finding Sal, I found Mrs. Adair's letter of recommendation on your table. I unfolded it and read it. It was written in her hand. It was also unsigned. I had watched you place a letter and money in your pocket after speaking to Mr. Adair on the day that he left for Belfast. It was the same letter that you had previously given to Mr. Adair, but that one was not the same letter that Mrs. Adair had given to you. It couldn't have been. I saw you leave the castle after your argument with Mrs. Adair. You did not have a chance to return to your room, he says. He turns around and looks directly at me. I knew then that you had previously given him something other than Mrs. Adair's letter of recommendation, and you did so after learning of his plans to evict his remaining tenants. He responded to your letter with delight and a purse full of coins. You then created a scene with Mrs. Adair, knowing that you would be immediately dismissed. You did this so that no one would question your absence because you planned to follow Mr. Adair. I knew that you two planned to rendezvous in Belfast, he continues. I look away. He turns around again. After your dismissal by Mrs. Adair, I searched for you. I had to know if my suspicions were correct. I was consumed with jealousy. I went to Mrs. Matterin's and inquired after you. I learned that she was not going to travel with Mrs. Adair after all, because she had fallen ill. I also learned that you had not been to the Glebe House that day. She was surprised that I was inquiring after you because old man Seamus had told her that he needed the day to take you to Letterkenny to visit a veterinarian. This was necessary because Sal was not well. On learning this, I remembered how I had seen you the day before handing Sal to old man Seamus at the stables. I could not believe that you would give Old Man Seamus your dog if you didn't plan to visit the veterinarian until the next day. To confirm my suspicions on that matter, I walked to Old Man Seamus's cottage. I did not find him, but I did find Sal. Sal was a gift from Mr. Adair to you. Why wouldn't you take her with you? You entrusted your dog to another's care because you worried that you might not return. As soon as this thought crossed my mind, I hurried to the castle. I hastily wrote a note to Mrs. Adair apologizing for the fact that I could not take her to Belfast. I told her an emergency had occurred and that I would explain everything later. I then left and started my journey to Belfast. I knew that you had not traveled with Mr. Adair. He would have insisted that you travel with someone else. He could not be seen traveling with a woman other than his wife. It would cause a scandal. I think of my journey with Old Man Seamus. We were silent. It was a journey of 10 hours. We reached Belfast only 2 hours after Mr. Adair had arrived. When our carriage pulled up in front of Mr. Adair's hotel, he came out to greet us. A figure behind Mr. Adair seemed to follow him. He didn't notice. He smiled at me. He leaned forward and kissed my cheek. I had smiled in return. It was then that I clearly saw the figure behind him. It was an old woman wearing a shawl. I looked at her. She held my gaze for a moment, and then she walked away. I watched her fade away, and then I followed Mr. Adair into the hotel. Dr. Foxo looks intently at me. I know that Mr. Adair arranged your travel. You traveled with Old Man Seamus. The coins were to cover the cost of changing horses midway through the journey. Old Man Seamus would not have taken you if you were traveling to Belfast to become Mr. Adair's mistress, he says. He turns again and faces the window before he continues. I followed you and Old Man Seamus. I arrived in Belfast about 2 hours after the two of you arrived. I knew which hotel to visit. I knew that he would only stay in the most expensive hotel in Belfast. I asked after him and was given his room number. I went to his room. Dr. Foxel is still turned away from me. I wait for him to continue. My mind floods with memories. I remember Mr. Adair's room. I remember the knife. It so easily entered his neck. He looked at me with alarm. I pushed it further into his neck. He began to choke. The blood spilled onto the pillow. It pooled quickly. I did not stop. Old Man Seamus had taken one of Mr. Adair's hunting knives and had hammered the handle until it was nearly gone. It no longer resembled the rest of his hunting knives. The rawness of the handle tore into my palm as I pushed the knife further and further into Mr. Adair's neck. Blood stained my hands and dress. I looked at his face as he struggled and choked. He could not take his eyes off of me. I twisted the knife. He jerked and finally stopped moving. I tore off my blood-stained dress and threw it into the corner of the room. I washed my hands in the wash basin. I quickly changed into the extra dress I had brought with me. Dr. Foxlow turns around again and looks directly at me before he continues. I entered the room and I saw him lying on the bed. He was already dead. I saw your dress in the corner of the room. I put it into the fireplace and made certain that it was thoroughly burned. He pauses before he continues. I did not follow you to stop you. I wanted to help you. I can see the truth in his eyes. He looks away from me and returns his gaze to the window. I sent a messenger to the castle and asked Old Man Seamus to return. I knew that the messenger would arrive shortly after the two of you had returned. I then waited until the following day. Mrs. Adair arrived. I met her in a hotel lobby. I took her to her husband's room. She did not scream. She stared at him with wonder and disbelief. I told her that he had been seen with a woman. If it became known that he had been found dead in a hotel room after having been visited by an unknown woman, there would be a terrible scandal. I told her that Old Man Seamus would arrive soon. She did not argue with me. We waited for him to arrive. When he did, we carried Mr. Adair's body out of the room with the help of a well-paid porter. Mr. Adair was returned to the castle, and Mrs. Adair resumed her journey. She returned 1 month later with the devastating news that her beloved husband had died quite suddenly in a hotel room in St. Louis, Missouri. He died by her side, and she, his dutiful wife, had brought his body home for a decent burial, he concludes. I walk to him. He turns and looks directly into my eyes. I did not follow you to stop you, he repeats. I know, Nathaniel, I say. He reaches for my hand and raises it to his lips. He is fire and I am water. I know that together we will overcome. Author's notes. On April 8, 1861, the evictions of Derivay began. The work of the sheriff and several constables continued for 3 days. By the time they had finished, 47 families were evicted. They had resided in 46 houses. 28 of these were leveled or unroofed. A total of 244 people were turned out to fend for themselves at a time when very few provisions existed for the destitute. More than 150 of those evicted were children. At least 13 families sought refuge at the Letterkenny Workhouse. This was a terrible fate because workhouses separated families, and the average workhouse was usually rife with disease. At least 140 young people were sent to Australia to start a new life. Their passages were paid by sympathetic Irish men and women already settled in Australia. Others were able to rent cottages on neighboring estates. Still others were able to take refuge with family members that lived nearby. Sadly, some were found wandering through the ruins of their cabins and cottages weeks after the evictions. Lastly, some likely took to the roads and never knew shelter again, which was a common enough occurrence in 19th century Ireland. John George Adair is reported to have died quite suddenly in a hotel room in St. Louis, Missouri, on May 4, 1885. His wife, Cornelia Wadsworth, followed him 36 years later. His Texas ranch, the J.A. Ranch, is still in operation. The murders of James Murray and Adam Grierson remain unsolved. Aoife Dorian and Nathaniel Foxlow are fictional characters devised to facilitate the telling of the story. The end. Thank you for listening to this recording of By Our Own Hands.